It's time for our Week in Review on the Joy Cardine Show. Each week at this time, we take a look at the week's top news stories from a pair of opposing political perspectives. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday. Well, here are some headlines from the week. The North Koreans explode another nuclear device. State Assembly Republicans roll out their fall agenda, including measures to provide high school freshmen with computers, a sales tax holiday, and more jail time for serious crimes. Our guests will weigh in on those legislative ambitions. Plus, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton square off on national security and veterans issues. Wisconsin improves in a new national jobs ranking and other top state and national political stories. What do you make of the Assembly Republicans' fall agenda? How do you feel about the sales tax holiday, tougher sentences for serious crimes, and tablets and laptops for high school freshmen? And which state or political story from the past week do you want to discuss? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. Or you can post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me introduce my guests. Chris Lotto is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, John.
And Spencer Black, former Democratic state representative from Middleton, vice president of the National Sierra Club and an adjunct professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joins us this morning from California. Good morning, Spencer. Thanks for getting up early.
It is early here, but glad to be with you, John, and good morning, Chris.
All right, well, let's start right out with the Assembly Republican agenda, which includes a sales tax holiday, tablets and laptops for high school freshmen, tougher punishments for serious crimes, a push to fund Wisconsin's transportation system, and more. We'll pick this apart as we go, but generally speaking, Chris Lotto, what's your reaction to the plans?
Sure. I think there are some good and interesting ideas here, and I'm certainly looking forward to hearing what Spencer has to say as a former Assembly Democratic leader himself. But I think that, in general, Assembly Republicans are, you know, setting the stage for what they want to do in 2017. And before the elections in November, they're laying out their roadmap for some specific initiatives that they want to target. And I think it's you know, the devil is always in the details, as the cliche goes, and some of these things are going to cost money, and some of these things we're going to have to see how Assembly Republicans envision these things actually working before we can really pass judgment. But I think in general, it's a pretty wide-ranging agenda touching on taxes and education and higher education and keeping it affordable in Wisconsin. So, you know, there's a lot here to chew on. And so, you know, hats off to the Assembly Republicans for stepping up and putting forward a big agenda for folks to consider.
Spencer Black, your reaction overall to the GOP plan?
Well, before we get into the devilish details, I'll say I'll at least give the Republicans credit. They have said what they're going to do if they're reelected. But having that being said, they're not going to do much. You know, public schools in Wisconsin have been cut by more than $1 billion in the last few years. Our higher education system has been cut and is in danger of losing its greatness. And these are really small bore items. We can go into the details, but for the most part, they don't do a whole lot to address the problems that Wisconsin economy is lagging the nation and our schools are being cut and suffering.
Governor Walker has called for a sales tax holiday on certain back-to-school items the first weekend in August starting next year, a priority is shared by Assembly Republicans. Walker said sales taxes would be waived on school supplies, computers costing less than $750, and clothing items costing less than $75. The total cost would be about $11 million. Should the state do this, Spencer Black?
You know, I think almost every session I was in the legislature, this was proposed. It never passed. And it has been proposed by both Democrats and Republicans. Again, it's small bore stuff. You know, if someone can't afford a $600 or $700 computer, the $25 or $30 off the cost for the 5% sales tax is not going to make a difference. What I'd rather see us do is reinvest in our public schools. You know, the public schools, you just had an item on the news that our rural schools especially have been cut, had their funding cut by 13%. Their suffering classes are being cut back. Class sizes are growing. There's a teacher shortage. What we need to do is reinvest in our public schools, make up for the big big cuts. But I think what this is, it may sound good, it may make a headline in an election year, but it doesn't address the problem that Wisconsin's educational system, which was once vaunted as one of the best in the country, has been cut, especially in the rural areas. They're really suffering. So let's put the money back in the schools rather than doing headline-grabbing symbolism that doesn't make much of a difference.
Chris, what do you make of this sales tax holiday proposal?
Well, every little bit helps. And if you have kids in school, you know that these purchases can really add up. And the items that we're talking about here are really necessities. So it does make sense to give families a small break and try to make it less expensive to buy these, you know, needed school items. I do agree with Spencer Black, and I don't even know if Spencer would remember, but as a reporter, I used to interview him, you know, way back when. We're going back a ways, but you have some history. So, you know, these ideas pop up regularly. This is not a huge savings. It is not going to be a large economic boost to the state. So anybody looking at it in that way is going to come away disappointed. It's not going to get the job done in that way. But it is a small thing that, you know, look, to some folks looking to buy a laptop for their kid, you know, saving $35 on a computer is significant savings, and people are going to appreciate that. So I think that it is worth doing it. I think it's a family-friendly move. To Spencer's point that there are bigger fish to fry, you know, he may be right, but I think that in this case it would be hard to imagine folks, you know, opposing this. But again, these sales tax holidays have been proposed an awful lot in the past and typically, you know, don't get through the legislature.
Speaker Voss called the computers for high school freshmen provision one of the Assembly Republicans' highest priorities. He says almost every assignment is done using the Internet or technology, and for students who don't have access to devices, they fall behind the curve. What about this idea, Chris?
Well, you know what? I absolutely agree, and I have a personal stake in this. My teenage daughter just started high school in southeast Wisconsin last week, public high school, and was given a Chromebook as part of that. So I think it's an idea that for some school districts is already catching on in Wisconsin because in that district they issued them to all kids. And I think it acknowledges that tablets and laptops are becoming the new standard, you know, just like textbooks, you know, were for all of us. I think that we're talking about laptops and computers as the new textbook that kids are really going to need. So I do think it's a forward-thinking idea from Assembly Republicans. And I think it's a good one, and we'll see how it goes. But I do think it's a good idea that's headed in the right direction, and some districts are already there.
Well, James on Facebook has a take on this, and here's what he writes. While I happen to think that providing a laptop for every student in the state is an idea that has a lot of merit, I also think they need to make sure folks in rural areas have reliable access to broadband internet so those kids can put those laptops to best use. So what about what James has to say there, Spencer, that it's a good idea, but we need rural broadband internet access too?
Well, I think that's a much greater priority. You know, none of these things are free. Chris said he used to interview me, and one of the things I did in the legislature is we had to balance the budget. So if you spend money on one thing, there's less money to spend on others, like our public schools. Everybody, you know, folks who say that the Wi-Fi and computers are essential to education today are, of course, right. The question is this the best expenditure? I mean, most students do have computers and Wi-Fi access. What I think is important is making sure that all students have it. So I'm not sure it's the best use of scarce tax dollars to give students who already have computers and Wi-Fi access another computer. What I would do is concentrate on giving computers to those students who don't have them, making sure students have Wi-Fi access. In rural areas, that means expanding our rural broadband, as your writer said. You know, the state, unfortunately, Walker, returned tens of millions of dollars of federal money, which was intended and could have been used to expand rural broadband, and was not. So I think opening this up to some of the smaller telephone companies where necessary, allowing them to expand Wi-Fi access. So I would concentrate and prioritize the use of our tax dollars to make sure that everybody, all the students do have computers, Not necessarily spending money to give computers to students who already probably have one or more devices, and also expanding broadband, both to those who don't, students who don't have Wi-Fi in their home, and especially to the rural areas, where we're really lagging in some areas in terms of making high-speed internet available, not just for education, but also for economic growth.
Let's take a call from Tim in Eau Claire here. Tim, thanks for joining us on the Week in Review.
Hi, I'm a very ardent Democrat, signer of the Walker recall petition, and when I grew up, I was very poor. My dad would go to thrift sales to get most of my clothing, and he would toss somebody down from 50 cents to a quarter, or from a quarter to 15 cents, and what that meant is that quarter or that dime could be spent at the next thrift sale to get me more items. I honestly have to say this is the first time I think Scott Walker may have gotten something right with the tax holiday.
All right, Tim, thanks for that call. Speaker Voss called for increasing jail time for serious crimes as a way of increasing public safety following the recent riots that broke out in Milwaukee. Are sentences too short for those involved in this kind of behavior, Spencer Black?
You know, we incarcerate in Wisconsin far more people than other states. I think we've tripled the incarceration rate in the last few decades, and I think our incarceration rate is double what it is in Minnesota, a state that's similar in population and in socioeconomic outlook. The problem here is, you know, our sentences for violent crimes are pretty serious already, and there's no deterrent effect in adding a few years to a sentence. What I do think we need is better policing. In areas, we need better community relations between police and the communities. And we also need to concentrate our criminal justice system on serious crimes rather than minor crimes, where we have a lot of people imprisoned who really do not pose a danger to public safety. When I was in the legislature, I did vote for legislation on terms of criminal penalties where I thought they were too short. Violent crime can rip a community apart. But the reality is this is often something politicians do to look good but really have little effect. I mean, if someone is committing a violent crime, they're not thinking they're going to spend 27 years in jail instead of 25 years in jail. That's not a deterrent. The fact that they may get caught and go to jail for an extended period of time is a deterrent. But the fact that there may be a couple of years added on to a sentence that already would be quite long has no deterrent effect.
Chris, do we need longer sentences for serious crimes?
Well, I do agree with Spencer to a point, and I think that this is way too complicated an issue to say in 30 seconds yes or no, because there's a lot of nuance here. I know that the speaker was even talking about, you know, if we're going to raise the penalty or the sentences for some crimes, you know, maybe we look at some other smaller ones to lessen those sentences, because you have to worry, obviously, about resources, you know, prison resources, corrections resources, and whether we have those to handle longer sentences and you know, perhaps, you know, additional people heading off to prison. So there's a lot of issues, and this is a real nuanced one that's going to need a lot of, you know, consideration, I think. To Spencer's point about whether it is a deterrent, I think, you know, they're thinking about it at the other end, which is to say that if you're, you know, a violent offender or a serious offender, you're going to be taken off the streets more. And in that sense, it is a deterrent, absolutely. So I don't disagree with this. I think that there is a lot more that we need to know about it. And I think this is an issue that's already going, you know, is already generating a great deal of debate. So we'll have to see where it goes. But I think that I think it's a good idea. I think that, you know, talking about dealing with it at the front end, I'd be curious to see how much we're going to take a look at things like, you know, community policing and how much that a strong police presence up front, you know, is a deterrent to crime in communities. And whether that's being done now or whether there are ways that we can adjust that to deal with things up front and make sure that we're not dealing with, you know, criminals at the end of the line and trying to deter it before it even happens.
And John, if I could just say a thing, a word here. I think this is one of the areas where liberals and conservatives are starting to talk in a little more depth and actually agree. And it might be the one area where I agree with a thrust from something that the Koch brothers are funding. You know, our approach to crime has been too simplistic. And there are some people, as Chris says, who really should not be back on the street. They're just violent and likely to commit violent crimes again. But on the other hand, we've imprisoned far too many people for nonviolent crimes and failed to rehabilitate some people who are capable of rehabilitation. So I think this is an area which does not lend itself to good policy if you just engage in headlines saying, let's throw them in jail for a few more years. But it's something where, at long last, I think people from all sides of the political spectrum are starting to take a look at our criminal justice policy and say, what will really keep our communities safe? And that's, I think, a good sign that there's at least that discussion beginning to happen.
I'd like to wrap up our discussion on the Assembly GOP agenda and then take a break by talking about trying to find a solution to the state's potential $939 million transportation funding shortfall. Speaker Voss said all options, including increasing vehicle registration fees and toll roads on the interstates, which, by the way, would need federal approval, need to be considered. So what would you like to see Republicans do to address the transportation budget problem? Chris?
Well, I'm not a big fan of toll roads. And, you know, it's registration fees by another name, as most Republicans will tell you, is really, you know, a tax hike. So the question becomes, are we as a state doing everything we can to make sure that these projects are being done in an efficient manner? Are there things that are perhaps not needed that we could put off? I guess we have to put everything on the table is my point. I have seen ideas on variations of toll roads, things like you pay for, you know, the privilege to have a special lane that you can drive in, and I think it allows you to drive faster or something like that. There are all sorts of ideas out there and a lot of ways to skin this cat. So, you know, and will that be able to happen quickly? I don't know. Will the federal government move fast and approve these things so we can address, you know, a shortfall that really is looming, that we need faster action on than waiting for the federal government to take the months or however long it's going to take to approve it. So I think we have to look at all of that. I'm certainly uneasy with it, but we are facing, you know, a giant hole that needs to be addressed. And I think that there is this general perception out there in Wisconsin that, you know, our infrastructure, our roads used to be the crown jewel of the Midwest. We always used to laugh at Illinois for their terrible roads. And I think, unfortunately, things have changed over time. And so we're trying to deal with this. The question is whether we just bit off more than we can chew right now.
Spencer?
You know, we have a real problem with maintenance of our current road system. You know, as a bicyclist, I experience the deteriorating roads quite intimately. However, I think we have to spend our money smarter. Rather than engaging in new large highway expansion, we should take our money and maintain what we have. The DOT has some very expensive and not needed projects on their books that they're pushing. What I would suggest is what we first do is put off a lot of these major projects, very expensive new highways, and invest in the highways we have and make sure we maintain them well. You know, if you're in some of our rural areas, our local and county highways are deteriorating because those local governments have not gotten the funding to maintain those roads. So let's put the money in what we got before we start spending large amounts of money in large new highway projects.
Where's concrete cleat when you really need them? Let's take a break, and we'll come back with more of our Week in Review in just a little bit. We're talking with Chris Lotto and Spencer Black about the top state and national political stories of the week coming up. We'll talk about presidential politics. We'll discuss foreign policy, a foreign policy forum that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton participated in this week, and North Korea's fifth nuclear test. We'll take your comments on these issues and other stuff you might want to bring up at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. John Munson in for Joy today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of WPR. We're talking about the top state and national political stories of the week with Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Wisconsin Republican Party and a GOP campaign consultant, and Spencer Black is former Democratic state representative, vice president of the National Sierra Club, and adjunct professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So, listeners, did you watch the Foreign Policy Forum with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and what did you think of what the two had to say? What about Matt Lauer's performance? as a moderator. What other political issues do you like? Would you like to discuss? 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or the Joy Cardine Facebook page. All three ways, great ways to get in touch. Okay, shifting gears to the presidential race. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton squared off more or less. They weren't on the stage at the same time, but they were both on the same program Wednesday night in separate appearances to discuss national defense and veterans issues. The event was moderated by Matt Lauer of NBC's Today Show, who was heavily criticized by many on the left for being too hard on Clinton and for not challenging Trump enough. Spencer, what did you walk away with after that forum was over?
Well, the first thing is Matt Lauer should never be a moderator of anything again. He did a terrible job, and it's not just liberals who say that. The NBC news executive was in the paper quoted yesterday saying that Matt Lauer was a disaster. So he's being criticized by his own network on this. I think that Matt Lauer did a terrible job. But what came out is it was amazing how many ridiculous things Donald Trump could say about foreign policy in half an hour. I'll give him credit. And Matt Lauer had a tough job, and I think the press generally has a tough job because Donald Trump says so many outrageous things and things that are outright lies in such a quick period that the press has trouble dealing with them. But I think the most troubling thing was what he said about his relationship with Russia, praising Putin. And in fact, he went on the Russian-owned network yesterday to attack the United States and again praise Putin. You know, Lindsey Graham said, and here's what Lindsey Graham, the conservative Republican, had to say about what Trump said. He said that, you know, Putin destroyed every instrument of democracy in his own country, has opposition people killed, is dismembering neighboring countries through military force. And he said that what Trump is saying unnerves him to his core. So I think the relationship between Donald Trump and the Russian government and the possible interference of Russia in our American elections has to be one of the top issues we look at. Putin is a bad guy, and having a presidential candidate who's cozying up to him and may even be benefiting by his actions, this murderous dictator, is really a dangerous thing to our country.
Chris, your general thoughts on what the candidates had to say and about Matt Lauer's performance as moderator?
Ooh, where do I begin? Well, I think that as a political pundit, Matt Lauer proved himself to be a great morning show host. So it sounds like
he's no Joy Cardine. That much we can say for sure.
You got that right. So I think you know he should go back to the Today Show where he belongs and you know leave this to others. You know, did Matt Lauer go light on Trump and not call him out on some of his contradictory statements? Absolutely. That said, the rest of the mainstream media was more than willing to jump into the fray and report on everything that Matt Lauer failed to challenge Trump on. So, you know, either way, Trump got grilled by a national news media, as he has been all along, well, at least since the primary's been over. You know, and I think, and this is a whole other issue, that, you know, you're seeing the mainstream media tying themselves in knots. I just read a long, I think it was an op-ed in the New York Times yesterday about how, you know, reporters are trying to justify the pretty clear contempt for Donald Trump. They're not really making a secret of it anymore. I think the mask of objectivity and fairness has kind of come off in the face of a potential Donald Trump presidency. So that's been interesting to watch. But beyond that, the second point I wanted to make is that, you know, Matt Lauer did do something that the rest of the media is generally failing to do, and that is to hold Hillary Clinton's feet to the fire over her, you know, highly questionable conduct as Secretary of State and really her sort of ongoing inability to just come clean and be honest about, you know, all the emails and the servers. I mean, this thing is not going away, and in typical Clinton style, it's this steady drip, drip, drip of stuff, new stuff that we're learning that is becoming, you know, really increasingly alarming. So, and interestingly enough, you know, Team Hillary is already using the Matt Lauer interview to their advantage. CNN was reporting this week that they're already using it to raise money. So, you know, don't cry for Hillary Clinton. They'll figure out a way to make lemonade out of those lemons.
Let's go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, just one final point. I think Hillary is not known for giving the press much access. In fact, she's notorious for not doing it, and it seems like, I think very late in the game, it seems like they're maybe starting to realize that that's, you know, this imperious attitude toward the press is not doing them any favors. And she went quiet, oddly enough, for a while here in the final weeks of summer. giving Donald Trump a real opportunity to mold, you know, Hillary into an image that is advantageous to him. So she's, you know, and the polls are reflecting that she's, you know, she's down. I think Matt Lauer saw an opportunity here to act like a journalist instead of a lightweight morning show host and grill Hillary. Unfortunately, he didn't do that for both candidates. And I'm sure a lot of her supporters were surprised to see this, figuring that, that Matt Lauer would go easy on her, and instead she got grilled.
Let's take a call here from Ned in Lake Dubé. Ned,
hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes. Regarding the forum this week, Donald Trump's shockers are really opposed by a large majority of Americans and should be remembered when people go to the voting booth. It's ridiculous that it seems like they come out and then people forget about them shortly after that. Let's just mention a couple of them. The generals are being diminished to rubble, is one of his quotes. And he would purge the generals and admirals and replace them with generals and admirals that were loyal to Trump. And another one is, if Putin says great things about me, I'll say great things about him. And Putin is a KGB operative for many years, and he knows how to use flattery to manipulate Donald Trump. This is highly dangerous if Trump became president. You know, how are we going to be manipulated by another country? You know, lastly, rape in the military. What did they expect when they put men and women together, according to Trump? Does he really want to remove women from the military? I mean, that is just an outrageous statement.
All right, Ned, thanks for that call. Donald Trump has insisted he's ready to be commander-in-chief despite offering vague plans for tackling global challenges. He said he didn't want to show his hand and give America's enemies any ideas. How confident are you, Chris, that Trump has a solid approach to dealing with the Islamic State, for example?
I have to be upfront and say that I am not a Donald Trump lover, and I have really, really struggled with his candidacy. I was not a supporter of his in the primary. I frankly was not overly thrilled with the choices that Republicans were given this year, but I think Donald Trump would not have been my pick in the first place. And I think certainly in Wisconsin there are plenty of conservatives and Republicans who are not just uneasy with the idea of a potential President Trump, but are outright opposed to it. And we know this already, and we saw from the results of the primary that, you know, Trump did not have, you know, a lot of love waiting for him in Wisconsin. So, look, I think people are right to be concerned. I think they are seeing a fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants campaign that has, you know, shifting messages from day to day and contradictory statements. I think that the whole relationship with Putin, people are wondering, you know, what's up with it, and why, you know, what does Donald Trump seemingly know about Putin that the rest of us don't, and that all the intelligence doesn't tell us. So, I have to be honest, I really struggle with it. Now that said, I'm kind of a man without a country, so I'm certainly not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. But I think that folks are right to question it, and I think that. You know, your caller, you know, gave us some statements, no real question there, but I think that people are going to have to take a close look at this. And I think that, you know, this vagueness may work to his advantage ultimately, because people may say, you know, we like his, you know, throw the bums out attitude, that they really want something truly different in for president, and they're not going to get it from Hillary Clinton, that's for sure. So, you know, that idea of a true outsider coming in and becoming president may appeal to them. But I think people are very right to be concerned, because they can't really get a bead on where he's at and what he's going to do, because it changes from day to day.
Spencer, do you trust Hillary Clinton to take on ISIS, especially when she says the U.S. should hunt down and kill ISIS leaders the way we did with Osama bin Laden?
You know, Hillary, I did not support Hillary Clinton in the primary. So Chris and I both have candidates for our party that we didn't support in the primaries, but I certainly vote for Hillary Clinton in general. I think that her approach, she's tough and stable. Donald Trump is mentally unstable, and his policy is unstable. Hillary Clinton, while I don't agree with everything she did, and I think she's not the best candidate in terms of, I think she'll be a better president than she is a candidate, actually. I think on foreign policy, she'll maybe be a little more hawkish than I would like, but she's certainly competent to lead a fight against ISIS. Think about what Donald Trump has said. First, he said that he has this secret plan, whatever that is, to fight ISIS. But then when he asked what the general, secret plan was, he said he would call his generals and ask them to give him a plan in 30 days. And then he said he would fire all the generals. I mean, he said so many things that are just not only untrue or demonstrably crazy during that half-hour interview that I don't think our country would be secure with him as commander-in-chief. But the thing that offended me the most, and I think it offended a lot of people, is what he said about women in the military. You know, when I was in the legislature, one of the saddest duties we had was to stand and for moments of silence to honor those people from Wisconsin who wore the uniform of our country and killed fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And many of those were women. And women serve courageously and have died in the service of their country and their military, continue to do so. And to say that they are to blame for these rapes in the military, I think rubs a lot of people who honor our military, honor their service, really rubs people the wrong way.
There was
I'm sorry, John. Can I jump in here for just a second? Because
sure.
I did want to just look at the ISIS situation, what Hillary Clinton said, and I am curious about what Spencer thought of that. So we know that Hillary Clinton came out and said that the U.S. should hunt down and kill the leader of the Islamic State group. She said that this week, and I think you won't get any argument from me on that. But the question is, what do you do after you kill him? And obviously, as we've seen before, there's always somebody else willing to jump up and take that person's place when the person is taken out. So I mean, it feels like Hillary's trying to reestablish her bona fides and look like a hawk after being off the radar for a while. And I kind of wonder about the double standard here, which is to say, Hillary makes this proclamation, and as far as I can see, and in doing my research for our conversation today, not really being challenged on saying this. And I wonder how many people would have, fainting spells in newsrooms across the country if Donald Trump were to make the same statement that we should just kill the leader of ISIS. And I'm curious what Spencer thinks of that particular point that Hillary made this week.
Well, that's a fair question, Chris. I agree that we should kill the leader of ISIS. And Hillary Clinton does have some bona fides on this one because she was Secretary of State when we took out bin Laden. So but I also agree with you that just killing the leaders or taking out bin Laden is not the solution. But it does help. I mean, you degrade their leadership as part of a long and tough fight. What is happening with ISIS is that they are losing. Well, they are sponsoring terrorist activities outside of Iraq and Syria. The reality is that very slowly, maybe way too slowly for our liking, but very slowly, ISIS is losing ground and losing their standing as sort of a pseudo-nation in northern Iraq and northern Syria. And I think that policy is important, to deny them a base in Iraq. And when it comes to taking out leaders, when you consider that Hillary Clinton was very closely attached to the policy involved in taking out Osama bin Laden, she probably has some credentials in this area.
All right. Well, our Week in Review needs to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with Spencer Black and Chris Lotto. Coming up, we're going to talk about some disquieting news from North Korea and the latest batch of rankings showing Wisconsin is 33rd in the nation now in job creation and the latest developments regarding the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. Which political issue do you want to talk about? 800-642-1234. WPR is, talk at WPR.org is our email address, or you can post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mm-hmm. John Munson in for Joy Cardine with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This, of course, is our Week in Review. Spencer Black, former Democratic state lawmaker, vice president of the National Sierra Club and adjunct professor of urban and regional planning at UW-Madison, and Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant, are both with me on the program today. Wondering what you think if Wisconsin is on the right or wrong track when it comes to creating jobs. Should the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline be scrapped, or do you want to see the project completed? 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. There was some unsettling news last night. A 5.3 magnitude earthquake was detected in North Korea. Turned out to be another nuclear bomb test by North Korea, their fifth. The move, of course, drew global condemnation. The White House says the U.S. is committed to the security of America's allies in Asia and will work with our global partners to ensure provocative actions from North Korea are met with serious consequences. Spencer, how concerned about this test are you?
Well, I mean, the dictator of North Korea is crazy, and he's dangerous. What the White House is doing is as good as you can do, which is make sure that our regional allies in the area are prepared to deal with North Korea if they have to deal with them militarily. We certainly hope it doesn't come to that. I think also China is much to blame here because they are basically North Korea's only ally, and they probably could exert pressure to roll this back. But North Korea has been a rogue state run by the Young family ever since World War II. And I think they do pose a real danger to the security of, if not the United States, certainly the Pacific Rim countries.
Chris, what would you like to see President Obama or the next president do about the North Korean situation?
Yeah, well, the administration talks about serious consequences, and it appears that they want to, discuss this, through the UN Security Council and other world leaders. It is clear that, that the sanctions that have been opposed, and I think the number is five sets of UN sanctions that have been issued since the North Korea's first test back in 2006, clearly aren't doing anything or doing enough because these tests continue. China, as Spencer pointed out, is a North Korean ally. They oppose this. But I think the question is, beyond these UN sanctions that are not getting the job done, what else can the world powers do to try and deter this? Because it is a dangerous rogue state, and we have to figure out how to do it. And I'm not going to pretend to have the answers, but I think that what is being put in place now is not working, and so we need to revisit it and take a closer look at what we can do that might work. And I don't know what the answer to that is. They're going to do what they're going to do, and which is why the possibility of a President Trump or a President Clinton, how they're going to handle it. With Hillary Clinton, I would expect that we're going to get more of the same that we've gotten under President Obama, which is to say not enough to get the job done and to deter this from continuing.
Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Shortly after the strike, America became a very united place. Now, not so much. What happened, Spencer, and what do you make of where we are as a country today?
Well, I think we're very polarized. This is not nationally. My experience is more at the state level. And I remember when I was first in the legislature, I was elected first years ago in 84. I used to work quite a bit with Republicans. I was Chris interviewed me. He'll tell you plenty of times I was a pretty strong partisan Democrat. I was a Democratic leader. But nonetheless, after you laid out your position, you'd sit down, you'd work together, you'd have a personal relationship with people across the aisle. We've become more polarized, both at the state and national level. It's very different than when I first started in politics. I don't think it's a good thing for us. And 9/11, I would say that after 9/11, it was exploited in the 2002 elections in a way that it shouldn't have been. And I think going into Iraq, which was justified on 9/11, but really was unrelated to that and was a terrible policy move, really was what destroyed the unity of this country, or some of the unity we had after 9/11. We should have used that unity for good things instead of political ends and to justify an unnecessary war in Iraq.
Chris, what's your take on how divided the country has become 15 years after 9/11?
Yeah, that's a complex question. You know, it feels a little bit like a matter of perception, you know, the idea of the glass being half empty or half full. And I think if you're looking at the world from one angle, it would be very easy to, you know, agree with the notion that, you know, American unity is falling apart. And if you look at the presidential race as one obvious example, it has exposed, you know, voter and citizen anger, frustration. It's highlighted, you know, the really deep divides that exist among us and feel like they're getting deeper. But I think from another angle, you know, just looking at the day-to-day kindnesses that people show one another, and perhaps you remove it from the political arena, I think you might come to a different conclusion. So, you know, is America changing in its attitudes? I think definitely. You know, I feel like the notion of patriotism is in danger and kind of under attack, and that to be a patriot today is seen by some as you know, kind of simplistic or even ignorant, and I think that's unfortunate. But, you know, questioning these things in itself is very American. So, you know, the issues that divide us are in a sense, in a weird way, kind of the things that unite us as well. So, you know, we collectively enjoy, as Americans, the freedom to disagree loudly. And the issue for me becomes, and Spencer alluded to this, you know, even if we disagree, are we still willing to be civil and respect one another's right to hold their own opinion, even when we're convinced that their opinions are wrong? I think Spencer Black said, nice guy, I always enjoyed interviewing him as a reporter, and I don't agree with him. But, you know, it is what it is, and we can, you know, respect differing opinions and be on our way. And I think that's where it feels like things are breaking apart, that there is a lack or an erosion of basic civility and respect for one another and their opinions, even when you don't agree.
Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson said he simply blanked when he was asked about Syria's largest city. He was asked about Aleppo, to which he replied, "What is Aleppo?" He said in a statement he thought it was an acronym for something. Is this a big deal, Chris? And maybe more importantly, can Gary Johnson reach the 15% threshold to get onto the debate stage later this month?
You know, it is kind of a big deal because his campaign is at an inflection point right now, because Libertarians and Greens on the left have a real opportunity to, I mean, look, they're not going to get elected president this year, but they have a real opportunity to make strides, to build their coalitions and to build their base and really, you know, prep for future elections where they can continue to grow what they gained on in 2016. So, you know, for Gary Johnson, you know, there are a record number of people kind of rejecting the major party candidates this year, and the door is open for a third party to make inroads. But there really isn't any room for error. So when you're running, particularly when you're running as a third-party candidate, and you know, while the chance of President Gary Johnson was already virtually non-existent before this interview, you know, he did himself no favors by making this mistake and appearing to be ill-prepared to talk about, you know, to talk about international affairs. And that's a real problem. He needs to get his act together, basically, and errors like this don't help. So I think particularly when he's striving to get to that magic 15%, and I think the numbers I recall seeing put him somewhere at around 7 or 8. So, you know, he was heading in the right direction, but there's no room to do anything wrong here. You got to get it all right. And if he doesn't, then I don't think he's going to make it.
Spencer, would you like to see Gary Johnson in that first presidential debate on September 26th?
Well, only if he meets the qualifications, and we'll see if he gets that percentage. You know, about Gary Johnson, I agree with Chris. The Libertarians actually have a real opening here. You know, I think people who might have voted for either Trump or Clinton were looking at the Libertarian Party. I mean, that's good news for them. The bad news is they're going to be judged to a different standard than they have in the past. They're not just a fringe candidate. People are actually looking at this person. If I vote for him as president, is he capable of being president? And, you know, it's not just the Aleppo thing, although that's obviously what's going to stick in people's minds. Johnson is really not qualified to be president. I think the Libertarians blew it. If they had run their vice presidential candidate, William Weld, former governor of Massachusetts, as their standard bearer, as their president, I think they'd be doing way better in the polls. I think they probably might be qualifying, passing that 15% threshold to be on the debate stage. But I think with Gary Johnson, while he might be a nice fellow, Aleppo is just one of a series of situations where he's shown that he really could not be president. And he's in a position now where there's an opening, and people are not just judging him as like a throwaway vote, but they're thinking, could this guy really be president? And I think he's shown consistently over the last month or so that he's really not up for the job.
All right. Let's take a call, and we're getting to the end of the program. Jeffrey is in Chicago. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Hello. So when we're talking about the snafu, I think it's going to be bad because it's probably going to hurt his chances to get on this first debate stage. Luckily, he'll have, there's more than one debate, and if he hits 15% for any of them, he'll be on that stage. But honestly, with his policies, like as a libertarian, his policies are like leave other countries alone and deal with our own problems right now. So while it's going to cost them a lot of things, like from what his policies are, which is leave them alone and don't worry about it, it's not entirely surprising that he made the snafu because his policy is let them deal with their own stuff and kind of fix a lot of the issues we have here at home.
All right, Jeffrey, thanks for that. I want to move on because we've got a lot of not much time and a couple of big issues to talk about yet. A federal judge is expected to decide today whether to block construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline that is supposed to pass near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation along the border of North and South Dakota. The tribe contends the project violates several federal laws, including the National Historic Preservation Act, and threatens the water supply and ancient sites it deems sacred. It says the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers should not have used a streamlined permit process when it reviewed the pipeline and that it didn't properly consult with tribal members. The Dakota Access Line is slated to be about 1,100 miles long and costs about $3.7 billion. What would you like to see happen with regard to this project, Chris?
Well, first of all, I'm certain that Spencer Black will have a far more detailed breakdown of this than I will. First of all, one would hope that the burial grounds themselves are being respected and properly protected. That said, how long has this been in the works? How much of this protest is being fueled by legitimate concerns over the burial sites, and how much of it is being driven by environmentalists who simply want to block the pipeline? I think that's part of the question. And hopefully today's decision is going to shed at least a little more light on this process and whether Native American tribes were given ample time to review the plans and raise their concerns, before the construction crews got down to work. Although that said, it's highly unlikely that today's decision is going to put this matter to rest entirely. There are probably, other court battles to be fought.
Okay, Spencer, a quick take from you, and then we're going to be just about out of time.
Well, I'm with the tribes. These pipelines have caused many disasters. You can look at the Kalamazoo River for how polluting they can be when they fail. At a minimum, you should have a complete environmental impact statement, not an abbreviated one. And tribes, Native Americans and their heritage has been disrespected in this country, and I think it's about time that they are given the due that they deserve as the original inhabitants of our land.
All right, 20 seconds from each of you on Wisconsin's latest jobs report. Chris first, and then Spencer, and then we're out of here.
It's good. We're heading in the right direction. Is it great? No. And I'm not going to presume to speak for the governor or for Assembly Speaker Voss, other Republicans in the legislature, but I think we want to do better. I think we're moving up the rankings in terms of our Midwest neighbors. I think there are only three states that beat us in the Midwest, so we are heading in the right direction. Jobs are being created, but we always want to do better. And the question is, how do we get there? But it's encouraging.
Spencer, last word to you.
We're in the bottom third of the country. This is the 19th consecutive quarter that we've trailed the nation in job creation. We're at the ninth of 10 Midwest states in job creation over the last 5 years. We need different economic policies in this state because the ones we have now are failing.
All right. Thank you very much, both of you, for your time this morning. It was a very enjoyable hour. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great being with you, and nice talking to you, Chris.
That was Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Spencer Black, former Democratic state representative, vice president of the National Sierra Club, and adjunct professor of urban and regional planning at the UW. Madison. Coming up on Monday at this time, Joy will be back with Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane for our September edition of Mondays with Mike. They'll get you up to speed on the latest on WPR programming and operations and welcome your feedback on what you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Kai Brito. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Hey, have a great weekend. Or whatever kind of weekend you'd like. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR.